quotations that are attributed to great men. There's one I came across a number of years ago. Whether it's genuine or not, I don't know. I can't vouch for the authenticity of it. But anyway, it's attributed to Yehudi Menuhin. And what he is supposed to have said is this. He's supposed to have said, "If I miss my violin practice for one day, then I know the difference. If I miss it for a week, then my friends know the difference. If I miss it for a month, then all the world knows the difference." We have something of that kind of contrast in the chapter in front of us, because you may remember from a fortnight ago, was it, or 3 weeks ago, that we were in chapter 7, and we saw there that the long-awaited revival came to the nation of Israel. Their hearts again sought the Lord, and there was a period when they were truly and wholly following him. But now here we have an odd situation. Something has happened. A very strong case could be made to argue that they still want righteousness. The reasons that they give for wanting a king are reasons which can certainly be construed as being good reasons, excellent reasons. They don't want to go off again in the same direction and have the same disasters that they have had within their lifetime. But there's no question about it. It's like Yehudi Menuhin after his month without a practice. The brightly burning faith has died down to a tiny flame. We don't know what the time lapse is between chapter 7 and chapter 8. It is probably about 20 or 30 years, something like that. In chapter 7, Samuel was right at the prime of his ministry, at the peak of his ministry, and in chapter 8, he's an old man, and they're thinking about a successor. But over that lapse of 20, 25, 30 years, the flame of faith has burned low, and there is a definitely lower spiritual temperature in the Church of God. Now we have to remind ourselves again that the history of the Bible is always history with a bias. It's not just a straightforward record of facts. Always there is an interpretation given. And the interpretation is given from the standpoint of the man of faith looking on, the man who is within the Old Covenant, who sees the Ten Commandments, who understands the law of God, and he interprets all that's happening in the nation in the light of God's declared revealed will. So it is in history with a bias, history with an interpretation. And here we have the story of how the first king was introduced, or the beginning of that story. During our Thursday evening Bible study, we've been beginning to look at one of the most difficult books in the whole of the Bible, the book of Revelation. We haven't got very far with it. We're just in the second chapter, and the second and third chapters consist of seven letters to seven churches in Asia Minor. And this past fortnight, we were looking at the first of these letters, letter to the church at Ephesus. And we saw that in spite of all their work, all their toil, all their obedience, all their doctrinal orthodoxy, the Lord of the church had something against them. And the thing that he had against them was this, that they had departed from the fervor and the zeal and the love that they had at the first. And I think really that this would be the charge that would be brought against the Church of God in Samuel's old age. Yes, you're still orthodox. Yes, you're still practicing the religion that was delivered to you. Yes, as far as that's concerned, everything in it is in its place. But I have something against you. You have fallen away from your faith and your fervor and your love. Well, let's try and look at it and understand it and apply it to our situation today. First of all, will you notice that this request that they made to Samuel for a king showed, lamentably, a lack of faith. Samuel is getting on, as we've noticed. He's a wee way from retirement yet. He still has to appoint Saul, and then years later he anoints David. So he's far from done, but they're conscious of the fact that his hair is very white and there's a stoop there. He's getting an old man, but there's still a brightness in his eye and an alertness in his mind. And more important than that, he's still in touch with God and able to deliver God's judgment and God's word. However, in preparation for his retirement as a kind of trial, he's appointed his two sons as judges. Now, I say a kind of trial because the odd thing is they were working or operating in a place called Beersheba. And there's a kind of expression in the Bible, from Dan to Beersheba. And from Dan to Beersheba means right from the north, John O'Groats, right to the south, Land's End. And Beersheba was, if you like, the Land's End of Israel. It was the last outpost of civilization. Beyond it lay the Sinai Desert. And so it's quite clear the fact that they were operating in Beersheba was that Samuel had given them a sphere of operation to see how they would shape up, to see if they had the integrity, the capacity to act as judges among the people of God. However, these two sons are not proving to be walking in their father's footsteps. And so the elders, seeing that they're worthless men and faithless men, seize this opportunity to demand of Samuel the appointment of someone else. A king is what they're after. Now, we have to analyze the situation. Who was their leader anyway? Was it Samuel? Well, it was and it wasn't. The theologians would say they were a theocracy. God was their king. And Samuel was simply a prophet, that is, his mouthpiece. The definition in the Old Testament of a prophet is a man who is God's mouth. You remember, the priest brings the people to God. The prophet brings God to the people. And so God is their king, and Samuel is simply God's mouthpiece. God had raised up Samuel at a time of absolute national blackness and disaster, time when the weakness of Eli and the wickedness of his sons had brought them right down to the very bottom of the ladder and made them slaves yet again of Philistia. God had raised up this boy, a no one, from a family of no account, from apparently nowhere, had brought him into the situation and had anointed him and made him judge in Israel. And God was able to use Samuel to appoint a successor, the person of his choice, who would act as his mouthpiece in this theocratic state. But the elders failed to see that. And their lack of faith was expressed in their fear that when Samuel died, the sons of Samuel would go the same way as Eli's sons and take the nation in the same way that Eli's sons had taken them. I suppose we should pause here to make a comparison or a contrast between Eli's sons and Samuel's sons. You remember, Eli was warned on three occasions about his sons, and he took no action. He was weak, and therefore he was judged. The same isn't true of Samuel and his sons. Apparently he removed them from office. They're never heard of again. In one way, the concern of the elders was good. It was good that they should look back and think back and remember the disaster of Hophni and Phinehas. But the problem was they'd made a wrong diagnosis. It wasn't just that Hophni and Phinehas had been bad leaders, bad priests, immoral, dishonest men. It wasn't just that. It was their own sin and failure. It's no use blaming Eli's sons entirely. It was the whole nation that left God. And that was what they failed to see. At this stage, they were putting the blame on others. God was able to deliver them. God was able to keep them. God was able to guide them. Samuel would be able to appoint under God's direction a worthy successor. But no, they felt insecure, and so they came with this request. And we heard it read, God saying to Samuel, they have not rejected you. They have rejected me from being king over them. They just can't trust me. They don't realize that I am the God who raised you up, and I can raise up someone who is worthy to take your place. This request comes first from a lack of faith. You know, we see God's working in the past. We go through this year after year and month after month. We can read about the way in which God has worked, but more than that, we can see in our own lives, our own congregation, the finger of God at work. We can see Him working. And then a new situation arises, and what do? We panic. What am I going to do? And we get all frenetic and all worried. How am I going to cope with this? And if only we would just think and say, now, what happened last time there was a crisis? And I took it to God. He helped me. He took me through. And the fact that this is an entirely different situation doesn't mean that God can't cope. If He could cope last time, can He not cope this time? And so we begin crying and worrying and wringing our hands. We do it every week almost, don't we? Panicking away. I'm sure that Kirk Sessions throughout the land have exactly the same experience. They get next year's budget. God has never let the church down. God has always supplied the needs. But these new figures, this increase, oh, how terrible this is, away beyond any realistic demand that can be made on us. However will we manage? Oh, I suppose I must have heard that the 21 years I've been in the ministry. How will we manage? We'll never manage. What will we do? Where will it come from? God expects us and asks us and demands of us that we trust Him for today, that we walk by faith and not by sight. And that basically was their problem. They wanted to have it all mapped out. They wanted to have that road in front of them so they could say, well, now next year such will happen, the year after such and such will happen, we've changed all the structures, we've got it sorted out, we know where we're going. The Christian life isn't like that. The life of faith isn't like that. The life of faith is by faith and not by sight, and that is very difficult. In one sense, a very dangerous illustration, but in one sense we're like blind people walking in the dark. But the thing is, we have a guide, and we put our hand into His, and He leads us and says, now you're all right, one step at a time, and I will keep you right. But we say, no, we don't want to go that way. We're not made like that, and we're not made like it, are we? We want to know exactly what's going to happen. And so we make our requests out of a lack of faith. But then secondly, notice, the request for a king showed not only a lack of faith, it showed the influence of the neighbors. Appoint now a king for us to govern us like all the nations. And then we get it again after they had been well warned and told what the implications of this monarch were going to be. The people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They refused. They said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. I suppose they'd seen the pomp and the pageantry of some of the other nations around them, the changing of the guard or the royal Rolls Royce, the grand processions or whatever they had in these late Stone Age, early Bronze Age days, all the fuss and palaver, they'd seen it. And they wanted in their way to be uppie-sides with the others, what they had, with their neighboring states, Ammon and Moab and Egypt and Syria and Philistia. You would think, really, that it was 1982, wouldn't you? How we hate to be different. How we hate not to have what others have. always looking over our shoulder and seeing what the other person has, what the next door neighbor has, what someone else at work has, seeing what they have, feeling sure that we're missing out if we don't have what they have. Now, of course, in certain matters, this is harmless enough. It's like this spit and polish in the barrack room. One starts it and then the next starts it, and so everyone has to do it. It's like fashions. And of course, in our modern economy, the whole consumer market cunningly exploits this longing of people to be the same as everyone else and to have what others have. I suppose now we're moving on to this personal headphone set. People walk down the street with it, listening to it. Or microwave ovens. I don't know what the next thing is. I suppose it's still really video recorders. But other people have got one, and so we must have one. And to a certain extent, that's a neutral territory, and it doesn't really matter. But you know, my friends, for the Christian, for anyone who would be godly, the point comes in our living when we have to be willing to be different, when we have to be prepared to take a stand, to see what's happening all around us, and to say, no, I'm not going to imitate that. I'm not going to go along with that. I will be different. Begins, of course, with the confession of faith. The Christian life begins with the confession of faith. That is why when men and women, young adults, join the church, they are asked to confess their faith publicly. And right from the very inception of the church, there has been this demand for a public confession. Those who attended the recent Reach Forth meeting saw this really very dramatically portrayed. Some of you perhaps didn't agree with it, where people were asked to march out in front of some great audience and make a public stand. And that may be very hard for some. Well, whether you make a public stand like that or not, the time comes, if we're going to be Christians, when we have to be willing to be marked men and women. And if we're not prepared for that, if we're not prepared to be different on moral and ethical issues, then we will never make Christians. When I was a young man, it was national service. And when we who sought to love and follow Christ in our youth fellowship came to say goodbye to the others, we knew perfectly well that when we went into national service, we would have to take a stand on certain things. In the barrack room, when you were square bashing, when all the others went out and indulged in all kinds of things, to be a Christian, you were going to have to say, as for me, I serve Christ and I follow him, and that's not for me. I suppose a parallel today would be a young woman going away from home, perhaps to nurse, live in a nurse's home. There, if she's going to be a Christian, she must make a stand. Not be like all the others in everything. Or a student going to university to live in halls has to be prepared to make a stand and say, no, I will be different. But it applies to all of us in our street, at our work, because there are deeper, more hidden influences, influences which affect our attitudes. Everyone's doing it nowadays. Everyone's doing it nowadays. That is virtually the theme of this chapter. Everyone has a king nowadays. What are we doing without a king? Ah, but Israel, your king is the Lord. Oh, no, that's not good enough for us. We must be the same as them. The parties and the drinking and the drugs, it's all the pressure, isn't it? Everyone's doing it. And yet right at the heart of our faith is this call, come out from among them and be different, be separate. Be holy, for I am holy, and holy means different as God is. And so this request arises secondly from pressure from their neighbors. But then thirdly, and very paradoxically, will you notice how the request for a king is granted? Here we come to the mystery of God's dealing with us. God does at times give us what we demand, even if it is not his best for us. There is a level of Christian living and Christian worship
and Christian congregational life with it which is not the highest,
not the best. And we are allowed to seize it and follow it. God doesn't impose his will on us. We have to embrace it. I know we sing in our hymn, "Make me a captive, Lord, and then I shall be free. Force me to render up my sword, and I shall conqueror be." And in one sense there's a truth in that, but in the other sense God will never force you to do anything. And he makes us a captive, but it's in love, and if we'll not respond to his love, then we will not be his captive and know the freedom that that brings. And so a warning is given. Oh, you'll have taxes to pay, and more taxes, and there'll be conscription. And he'll impose all kinds of burdens on you, this king that you're demanding. But if you demand it, then you will have it. We have a comment of a later theologian, if you like, a later priest in the Psalms on this. He granted their request, but sent leanness into their souls. These people thought a change of structure would change the demands and the dangers of godliness versus ungodliness. A king would somehow rid them of weakness and corruption and failure. Let's change the setup. That'll make things better. But as we've already noticed, that was a cop-out. For all the wrong reasons. Outside, ungodly influence and lack of willingness to walk by faith. Those were the real reasons why they wanted the king. It was the influence of their neighbors, the unwillingness to walk day by day in touch with God. They wanted to have it all cut and dry to see where they were going. And they were the losers. Subsequent history shows that, how they were the losers. Even with a king, the backsliding still came. The corruption crept in. The problem wasn't the structures, really. The problem never is really the structures, not in our Christianity, it's within ourselves. Well, God gave them their king, a whole line of kings, until another king should be given, King Jesus. When the last king, Zedekiah was his name, was finally deposed and taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar, a prophecy was made that no king would enter Jerusalem by the golden gate until he should come whose right it was. And right enough, there has never been a king since. For King Jesus is still to come in the fullest and finest sense. He is to have the place among us in our living that God himself wanted in Samuel's day. Our king is to be Christ. And if we are to really update this passage and put it into its New Testament context, it's as if we're rejecting the Lord and wanting some other way, the Lord himself. And so there are these three strands which apply to us that we need to walk by faith and not by sight. I wonder how we are as far as that is concerned. Isn't it very easy to slip into being so organized, into being in our spiritual lives, I mean, into being so organized in our spiritual lives, so cut and dried, so cold, so orthodox, so correct in what we believe, so correct in what we do, that we lose that daily touch with the Lord Jesus himself. I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love that you have at first. Come back and walk by faith and not by sight. Let us put our hands into Christ's hands and go with him. And then that demand laid on us to be willing to be different and not to mimic the world and not to adopt its attitudes, not to adopt its thinking and behavior, but to be willing to stand out as followers of the Lord Jesus and not ashamed of that. And then God's best for us. We can, you know, slip down to a lower level quite easily. The whole of the Bible is concerned with these levels of our Christian living. I think it was D.L. Moody who said, "The world has yet to see what God can do with a man who is wholly given to him." So few of us are wholly given to him. Paul said, "Be filled with the Spirit." Don't just allow the Lord into the front room of your house as a guest. Let him fill every part of your being. Let him into the kitchen. Let him into the living room. Let him into the glory hole. Let him into the attic and into the basement. Let Christ fill you. Don't walk with him half-heartedly. Choose God's best. Give all of your heart and all of your life to him. Don't opt for a lower level, and he will bless you, and he will reward you richly.